Last week, KBOO reporter Tony LaTigra spoke with a UW spokesperson, Norm Arkins, about the shooting on campus on January 20th during a protest against former editor at supposed news organization Breitbart Media.
Well, just about carrying a firearm, I understand the shooter is, although we don't have names, was a student at UW. Is that, can you, are you?
We don't know who the shooter, no one's been charged. We don't know who the shooter is.
Okay. So
police, it's an open investigation. Police are still working very hard on it.
If it was a student, then would there be, you know, consequences from the university against him for bringing a firearm? But I guess we...
Oh, sure. I mean that's a hypothetical for any circumstance. Guns are prohibited on campus, and if a student were to bring a gun onto campus, they'd be subject to student disciplinary action under the student conduct code. But we don't know that in this case because we don't know who the shooter is.
The victim of that night's shooting, so far unidentified by name, is a member of the IWW, or Industrial Workers of the World. The Industrial Workers of the World, also known as Wobblies, are notorious for doing what bosses view as causing trouble in workplaces. They call it worker organizing, and are mounting grassroots campaigns across an array of industries. The IWW at large has made widespread press attention since its member was shot on Inauguration Day, but hasn't participated in many in-depth press, interviews with the press. Under the condition of anonymity, I was able to speak with the Seattle IWW's press secretary over the weekend.
I am the communications secretary, the current communications secretary, that is, of the Seattle IWW branch.
Can you talk a little bit about what the IWW is and what is distinct about the Seattle branch?
Well, the IWW is an industrial internationalist union, radical labor union. The stated goal of the IWW is the abolition of the wage system. Pretty lofty goal, right? Something that we've been working very hard on since 1905 when the IWW was founded. In regards to the Seattle branch specifically, you know, the Seattle branch and radical labor organizing in general has a very long and storied history in Seattle and the greater Pacific Northwest. Over the past few years, the Seattle branch has was kind of undergoing a little bit of a drop in activity, but in, you know, given what happened with the election and, you know, the extreme level of threat that the working class is under with both people like Trump or Hillary Clinton or anybody else from either of the two parties in office, you know, it represents, both of those parties represent a major threat to the working class. And so I think largely in part because of that, the IWW has fortunately been seeing a large uptick in activity over the past year or two.
Cool. And so for people who aren't as familiar with the IWW and like the super rich and storied history, what was the IWW, what would have brought the IWW out in a show of dissent or protest against the inauguration? And I guess, and was that intended to wind up on the UW campus?
The question of the Trump regime and what that represents to the IWW, we view that as a dire threat to the working class insofar as that you can see, for example, Republican legislators since Trump has taken office have introduced federal legislation to essentially make the entire country a right-to-work country, which is incredibly anti-union. It really gives all of the power to the bosses to do as they please with the workforce. And that represents one of the highest levels of threat to the working class that we're facing right now. In addition to that, you know, the National Labor Board now is under the control of the Trump administration, and that as well represents a high level of threat. The NLRB is generally what unions, including the IWW for the locals that have collective bargaining agreements, we rely to a certain extent on the NLRB to enforce certain laws against bosses. And with the Trump regime running that, it makes it a lot more difficult to ever rely on that. Not that the IWW did so much, because we know that anything that comes from the state is going to be suited towards the bosses. But regardless of that, it still is a big threat to us. Regarding Milo specifically, it was a very conscious decision on behalf of our branch to mobilize specifically to oppose Milo. And there's a couple of reasons for that. We feel that the type of speech and actions that Milo engages in are bigotry of the highest order. He attacks transgender folks. He attacks women. He attacks people of color. He attacks Muslims. And all of these are different populations that are very, very much so heavily represented in the working class, right? And one of the reasons that we think that it's so important to mobilize to try to deny a platform for these types of ideas to be expounded upon and propagated out to the general public is, well, for one reason, workers who are afraid of a very racially hostile environment, they're a lot more difficult to organize. I know one of the other IWW locals in the U.S. right now, as soon as Trump got elected, one of their organizing committees who they had been working on a campaign to get a workplace organized, one of the main people on the committee who was a gentleman from Mexico, had to drop out of organizing because he was too scared of the potential repercussions that he would face under the Trump regime. So on that fact alone, you know, organizing against hate speech is very much a part of the program of organizing the working class. And then if you want to take if you want to look through a historical lens of how fascism has impacted the working class, you can look at the Weimar Republic, you know, in the buildup to Nazi Germany. The Weimar Republic, the Nazis were able to utilize a lot of populist pro-worker policies to engage their working class into supporting a very, very terrible fascist model. And if we can organize against those level of like fascist ideas as they start to reemerge in our society, then that can help us prevent the working class from being subsumed into fascist ideology and mobilized along those lines. It's about providing an alternative, right? If there's nobody who is speaking from the general left up on behalf of the working class, then it's a lot easier for people like Trump, who have a lot of populist policies, such as his opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, if he's the only one who's speaking up for workers against these kind of those types of policies, then workers are going to flock to that. So it's about providing an alternative to that level of dialogue as well.
So speaking of the general left, there is, I think, some widespread generalized confusion about what ought to be allowed. And I think as of late, there is this discussion specifically from like high profile liberal institutions that are in place supposedly to protect civil liberties, like the ACLU. They issued a statement last week on NPR. It was like one of the senior legal advisors, I think, on the East Coast, said that hate speech, even though it is deplorable, even though these views aren't at all in line with what the ACLU puts forward and defends, is like an important First Amendment protection. And it hurts really badly to see people being swayed by that and kind of buying into that idea. So can you kind of respond to that idea and what either legally or morally the IWW sees as problematic about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely the big debate around this topic, right? Free speech, you know, the people who founded this country definitely placed a very high priority on what they felt was free speech. But I think to begin with this discussion, it's important to know what exactly free speech is, which is it's the law that has codified in that stating that the government cannot prevent people, citizens, from engaging in certain types of speech. Free speech doesn't mean that you have freedom from consequence for the terrible things you're saying from individuals or communities who very well may mobilize themselves against you. And free speech also as an ideology, free speech assumes a certain level of equality between everybody who is, you know, supposed to be engaging in this free speech. But we live in a very inequitable society. We live in a society where there are so many different ways that people can find themselves oppressed, whether it is along class lines with the working class or racial lines with people of color who witness a high level of both institutional and personal racism and oppression. The idea that free speech is just this blank slate where anybody can come and say what they want totally ignores that level of institutional oppression that many different people face in our society. And that's one of the reasons that we find it kind of almost gross in that sense, in that it really is ignoring an entire underlying social context that is there. When it comes to Milo himself and free speech, I don't think free speech is something that Milo himself really even cares about. I mean, of course, that's how he defends himself. But when you look at Milo's personal history when it comes to free speech, he was part of that entire Gamergate situation, which for anybody who's not familiar with that, you know, certain feminists from within the video game industry spoke up about how the terrible levels of misogyny that they were experiencing within the industry, and it turned into an entire campaign against these feminist scholars and speakers and bloggers and so on. And Milo was a big personality in propagating this war against these feminists who he claims feminists are destroying feminism. It's bizarre, really. But I mean, these women who had spoken up against the misogyny, they faced a level of attacks from Milo and his supporters that went so far as to even drive some of them in out of their homes and to change their identities because the level of harassment they were facing. And all they were doing was engaging in their own version of speech. Those feminists were saying, hey, there's something seriously wrong with the video game industry. And because of that, Milo and his followers attacked them to the point where it severely impacted their lives. So I don't think Milo actually cares about free speech. I think that's something that he just tries to couch his bigotry in so that he can have a certain level of enjoy a certain level of defense from both institutions such as University of Washington, as well as people like Bill Maher, who just had him on his show this past Friday.
Right. I actually haven't seen that, and I don't know if I will. I don't know if I could stand that.
if you watch it, just watch it for Larry Wiltmore really shutting down Milo, because that was the only highlight of an otherwise very dismal thing.
Okay. I'll watch the highlight reel. one of my colleagues was able to get an interview with the media secretary or lead PR person from UW who spoke on the university's behalf and their decision, their defense really of the decision to allow Milo to speak on campus. And they essentially said something very similar to what a lot of apologists and defenders, so-called defenders of the First Amendment are saying. What kind of institution of higher learning would we be if we didn't let right-wing student organizations bring whoever they want to campus? To which my colleague asked, so what if, you know, they invited the Grand Wizard of the KKK? And they didn't really have much to say in response to that, even though it is like a really kind of baity question and an extreme example. But given that the president of University of Washington had a sibling that was murdered by white supremacists, I believe in North Carolina themselves.
Mm-hmm.
What is your / the IWW's reaction to that? And what ought to be the obligation of institutions like the University of Washington in potentially being able to mitigate a lot of, or maybe even just restrict the amount of publicity and audience that people like Milo Yiannopoulos are able to reach in these campus speaking tours, which I know are like money machines for them.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky situation. You know, I certainly don't envy the president of UW. You know, as you noted, her brother was murdered by the KKK at the Greensboro Massacre back in, I believe it was the 70s. So she has her own, you know, history with dealing with this much more severely than many of us will hopefully ever face. But when it comes to the institutional response, yeah, we are, as a, you know, as the Seattle IWW, are approaching it with, one, definitely a high level of frustration, but more importantly, two, not a whole lot of surprise, right? We recognize that in a country that was built upon and founded upon white supremacy and capitalism, that there, when it comes to legally recognized institutions such as UW, we're not going to find a lot of protection from them. And while we would, you know, while it would be great if they could offer that, we also don't really find ourselves too compelled to continue petitioning them for more protections. There's plenty of student groups and faculty members on campus right now who are doing that, and that's just not where we would like to focus our energies as the IWW. What we would like to focus our energies on is developing our own methods and our own organizing projects that, instead of these institutions, you know, expecting them to protect ourselves and the campus community, we would like to find ways that we ourselves can do that. Our member who was shot on January 20th, one of the very first things he said as he was coming out of his first surgery was that he has no interest at all in cooperating with the state, that he would prefer to engage in a restorative justice process with the person who shot him, which we have, you know, we found one pretty amazing, that somebody, as they're just barely starting to recover from being shot, that's the first thing that comes to mind for them. But one of the reasons that he feels drawn towards that is that it takes the power away from, you know, UW Police Department. It takes power away from the UW administration, who, to begin with, had no interest in really taking proactive steps to protect us or the rest of the campus community. Rather, it's us taking those steps to do it ourselves, right? You know, we would like to see, rather than asking, you know, asking the University of Washington administration to renegotiate the labor contract for their graduate student teachers, rather than asking for like an updated contract with provisions about protecting against doxing, we would much rather see, you know, us providing workshops to faculty and students on how to protect yourself from doxing, right? We don't need that to be codified into law. We need to be taking those steps ourselves to protect ourselves.
A full-length 20-minute version of this interview is available on our website at kboo.fm. For KBOO News, I'm Kanan Schlesinger.